Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is January 1st. Welcome to Episode 1. To understand where we are going, we have to start at the beginning. And that date is July 4th, 1776.
We know the date. We know the fireworks. But today, we need to strip away the folklore and look at the cold, hard political reality of that day. Because independence was not inevitable.
Not at all. In fact, for the first year of the war, from April 1775 to early 1776, most Americans were not fighting for independence. They were fighting for redress of grievances. They wanted to turn back the clock to before the taxes started. They were toasting King George III at dinner parties while shooting at his soldiers in Boston.
So what changed? How did we get from loyal subjects to July 4th in just a few months?
Two things changed the calculus. First, the king made it impossible to go back. He declared the colonies to be in open rebellion and outside his protection. He hired Hessian mercenaries, German soldiers, to come and crush them. That offended the colonists deeply. It felt like a betrayal by a father.
And the second factor was a pamphlet. In January 1776, an Englishman named Thomas Paine published Common Sense. It was a viral sensation. He argued that it was ridiculous for an island to rule a continent. He shifted the conversation from taxes to destiny. Without Thomas Paine, we probably don't get to July 4th.
So let's go into the room in Philadelphia. The Continental Congress. We tend to think of them as a united group of patriots, but they were actually deeply divided.
Violently divided. You had the Radicals, led by John Adams of Massachusetts and Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. They had been pushing for independence for months. They believed the war could not be won unless they declared independence, because foreign nations like France wouldn't help a bunch of rebels. They would only help a sovereign nation.
And on the other side?
The moderates or conservatives, led by John Dickinson of Pennsylvania. Dickinson was a patriot. He had written against British taxes for years, but he believed that declaring independence now was suicide. He argued that without a guaranteed alliance with France, and without a stable government in place, they were just signing their own death warrants.
Dickinson actually called it skiffing over the river in a paper boat during a storm.
Exactly. And he wasn't wrong. It was a massive risk. But by July, the tide had turned. On June 7th, Richard Henry Lee proposed the resolution that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states.
But they didn't vote on it immediately. The middle colonies, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, weren't ready. They stalled. So on June 10th, Congress voted to postpone the final decision for 3 weeks to give those delegates time to write home and get new instructions.
During that postponement, they appointed a committee to write a draft of the declaration, just in case the vote passed.
The Committee of Five, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and Robert Livingston of New York.
Now, John Adams was the bulldog of the group. He was the one driving the debate. But he refused to write the document.
Right. Adams knew he was obnoxious. He knew he had made too many enemies in Congress. He told Jefferson, "I am suspected and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. And besides, a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business."
So Jefferson, at only 33 years old, sat down in his rented rooms and wrote the draft. He didn't think he was writing scripture. He thought he was writing a legal brief. He drew heavily on the Virginia Declaration of Rights by George Mason and the philosophy of John Locke.
When the Congress reconvened on July 1st, the fight resumed. John Dickinson made one last, passionate speech against independence. He argued they should wait for the military situation to improve. But John Adams stood up and gave the speech of his life, arguing that the time was now or never.
And on July 2nd, the actual vote happened.
This is a crucial detail. The legal act of becoming the United States happened on July 2nd. That's when the Lee Resolution passed. 12 colonies voted yes. New York abstained because they were waiting for permission from their state convention.
John Adams was ecstatic. He wrote to his wife Abigail that July 2nd would be the great American holiday. He said it would be celebrated by succeeding generations with pomp and parade, with shoes, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other.
He got the celebration right, but he missed the date by 2 days. Because once they voted for independence, they had to explain why to the world. They turned to Jefferson's document.
For 2 days, July 3rd and 4th, Congress sat as a committee of the whole and edited the text. And they were ruthless editors.
Jefferson sat in the corner, fuming, while the delegates cut about 25% of his text. They removed his flowery language. They removed his attacks on the British people, because many delegates still had family in England.
But the most significant cut, and the one that haunts American history, was about slavery.
Yes. Jefferson had written a scathing paragraph blaming King George for the horrors of the slave trade. He called it a quote, cruel war against human nature. He accused the king of forcing the trade upon the colonies.
It was a powerful passage, but it was also hypocritical, since Jefferson himself owned over 100 enslaved people. But the politics were clear. South Carolina and Georgia refused to accept the declaration, if that clause remained.
And the northern delegates, many of whom were merchants involved in the shipping of enslaved people, didn't fight to keep it. To maintain the Union, they compromised. They prioritized the alliance over the moral consistency of the document.
It was a deletion that kicked the can down the road, straight toward a cliff. By editing out that condemnation, they didn't solve the problem. They just guaranteed that it would eventually be solved by a civil war.
By the evening of July 4th, the editing was done. The document we know today was approved.
Let's look at the document itself. It really has two distinct parts.
Right. The preamble is the philosophy. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That is the mission statement. It asserts that rights are pre-political. You are born with them. The government doesn't give them to you. The government exists to protect them.
But the second part, the part we don't read as much today, is actually the longest part, the grievances.
The indictment. This is a legal list of charges. They accuse the king of 27 specific crimes. They don't just say he's mean. They say he has dissolved representative houses, he has obstructed the administration of justice, he has cut off our trade.
There is a specific grievance about the frontier, too.
Yes, they accuse him of inciting merciless Indian savages on the frontier. It reflects the brutal reality of the border war going on at the same time. They also accuse him of inciting domestic insurrections, which was a coded reference to Lord Dunmore offering freedom to enslaved people who fought for the British.
So this document was designed to prove to France and to Spain that this wasn't just a riot. It was a legitimate government resisting a tyrant.
Exactly. It was a diplomatic tool.
So the vote passes on the 4th. Now we have to bust the biggest myth of the day, the signing.
Right. We have that mental image of all 56 men lining up on July 4th to sign the big parchment. That did not happen today.
No. On July 4th, it was just an administrative order to send it to the printer.
The printer was John Dunlap. He worked through the night to print about 200 broadsides. These were just posters. They were sent out by horseback the next morning to the generals and the state assemblies.
Most of the delegates wouldn't actually sign the official parchment, the one in the National Archives, until August 2nd.
Now, Leah, we have to talk about the mood in that room. We imagine triumph. But what was the reality?
The reality was fear. You have to remember the context. While they are debating commas and clauses in Philadelphia, the largest expeditionary force in British history is arriving in New York Harbor.
30,000 troops, hundreds of ships. It was an armada. The British were preparing to crush the rebellion in one single blow. The men in Philadelphia knew that. They knew that by signing this document, they were explicitly committing treason.
The penalty for treason was death. By hanging, drawing, and quartering. That's why Franklin's quote, "We must all hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately," wasn't just a witty joke. It was a statement of fact.
And it's worth noting that John Dickinson, the man who refused to vote for independence because he thought it was premature, what did he do?
He didn't sign it.
He didn't, but as soon as the vote passed, he left the Congress, and shortly afterwards he put on a uniform and rode out to lead a battalion of militia to defend New Jersey against the British. He disagreed with the decision, but he fought for the result. That is the complexity of 1776.
So as we wrap up episode 1, the United States exists on paper, but it does not exist in reality yet.
No. On July 4, 1776, the United States was an idea. A very fragile idea defended by a ragtag army that was about to be outnumbered 2-1 in New York.
The Declaration didn't win the war. It just raised the stakes. It changed the war from a civil conflict into a war for survival. There was no turning back.
Join us tomorrow for episode 2. We are going to flash back to 1763 to see the victory that bankrupted the empire and started this whole trouble in the first place. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story.